From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Parental Rights Amendment, a ballot measure in Colorado, is the latest item on the Christian conservative agenda. We'll have a debate. And today's an International Day of Action against Corporate Dominance.
This is a letter from a preschool student involved in trying to make the companies responsible. It says, "Dear managers at the Gap, please don't buy from sweatshops. I hope you know what they do. They lock little girls up and make them work. These children are just like me. They should go to school instead of sweatshops. I like your clothes, but I'll stop buying from you until you stop buying from sweatshops." From Suzanne Pope. P.S. I told my class on you.
A speech on sweatshop labor and a discussion on the case against globalization. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Democratic National Committee will not file a pre-election report detailing its contributions and spending for the first time in the two decades since the federal election law was written. The pre-election report covers activity in the first 2 weeks of October and is the last public accounting of a candidate or political party's financial situation before the election. Both Republicans and advocates of campaign finance reform call it illegal. The DNC's decision not to file a report came after 2 weeks of intense media scrutiny of its fundraising. One of those fundraisers is the DNC's John Huang, formerly with the Indonesian conglomerate Lippo Group. Today, he faces unlimited questioning in a civil suit against the Commerce Department. A federal judge denied Huang's request yesterday that questioning of him in the lawsuit be limited in scope. In a written order, U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that videotapes of Huang's deposition scheduled for today may be provided to the press and public. I feel a commercial coming on. And in the last public report before next Tuesday's election, the Republican National Committee reported that it made a $2 million contribution earlier this month to a tax reform group closely allied with the GOP cause that is not required to report how the money is spent. In a separate disclosure, the California Republican Party reported that media tycoon Rupert Murdoch has given $1 million to the party in the last few months, including $750,000 earlier this month, one of the largest political contributions in the state's history. And now we turn to the Senate and House races. In the Senate, there are 10 Senate races that are too close to call. If the Democrats are to retake the Senate, the Democrats would have to win 9 of those 10 races, like the Minnesota rematch between Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone and former Senator Rudy Boschwitz, the North Carolina race between Republican Senator Jesse Helms and former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt. And there's the Massachusetts race between Democratic Senator John Kerry and Governor William Weld, a dead heat. Last night was their last debate, and for the second time, the CIA cocaine allegations came up. You may remember that last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee held a hearing on whether the CIA was involved with drug running in the 1980s to illegally fund the Nicaraguan Contras. Well, several times in that hearing, William Weld's name came up. It was charged that as head of the Justice Department's criminal division in the late 80s, he actively scuttled a productive inquiry. This during Senator John Kerry's subcommittee investigation into the charges. Last night, Senator John Kerry alluded to Weld's actions.
"I was the first United States senator to challenge Star Wars on the floor of the Senate. I also led the fight to help keep Massachusetts sons and daughters out of an illegal war in Central America. And I gave this governor evidence of the illegalities of that war when he was in the criminal division in Washington, and he did nothing about it at that time. So I think there is a clear sign of distinction between us. Who is willing to take the tough fight? Who is willing to try to guarantee that the laws are upheld? I did it. He didn't."
Governor Weld.
John, let me just say, as I have said before, I think we should all be grateful for your service in Vietnam, and I am grateful for your service, which I think is distinguished service. With respect to the matter that you mentioned about the alleged conspiracy by the CIA and the American government to sell crack cocaine into our inner cities to somehow undermine America, I think that's a complete hallucination. And if you spend your time in the Senate chasing will-o'-the-wisps like that, it's no wonder you don't have time for the meat and potatoes.
But not all Republicans agree with the Republican governor of Massachusetts. The Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, doesn't take the same view. His committee will continue to monitor the new investigations into the CIA cocaine connection. And on the House side, the body considered more likely than the Senate to go Democrat. There was another debate in a close race this week. This is the redistricted 4th District of Georgia between Democratic incumbent Cynthia McKinney and her challenger, business attorney John Mitnick. Here's an excerpt of the debate when the candidates question each other.
Mr. Mitnick, who you may ask the first question.
Okay. Ms. McKinney, in 1994, Congress passed a resolution condemning a racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic speech given by a senior lieutenant of Louis Farrakhan. The resolution was sponsored by Representative John Lewis, who passionately urged his colleagues on the floor of the House to vote for it. He said, when one of us is attacked, all of us are attacked. Anytime such hateful expression rears its ugly head, it should not go unchallenged. 361 members from both parties voted in favor of that resolution. You were the only member of the Georgia congressional delegation to vote against it. Why?
First of all, let me say that that speech was indeed abhorrent speech. But I voted against that resolution because not in the 200-year history of our country has Congress passed a resolution to condemn speech. We had an opportunity to co-sponsor a resolution to condemn the speech of G. Gordon Liddy, which I declined to do.
And that was the debate, an excerpt of the debate between Democratic incumbent Cynthia McKinney and John Mitnick in the 4th District of Georgia. We'll be bringing you more coverage of these races throughout the week. You're listening to Democracy Now! The right of parents to direct the upbringing and education of their children shall not be infringed. The legislature shall have power to enforce, by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article. These 32 words are causing a firestorm of political activity in the state of Colorado. The Parental Rights Amendment is the first state ballot measure to reinforce parental authority and limit government involvement in family life. It's been put on the ballot by Christian conservative groups who see Colorado as a test case for taking similar initiatives to voters around the country. Joining us now to discuss the Parental Rights Amendment are two Colorado activists who are leading efforts for and against the measure. We're joined by Leslie Hanks with the Coalition for Parental Responsibility, which has support from national groups like the Christian Coalition and James Dobson's Focus on the Family. And we're joined by Pat Stedman, Deputy Campaign Director for Protect Our Children, a coalition of 140 groups fighting the amendment. Why don't we begin with Leslie Hanks of the Coalition for Parental Responsibility? Tell us why you put this measure on the Colorado ballot.
Well, we named our organization Coalition for Parental Responsibility because we like the acronym CPR. We believe that the role and rights of parents in America have been under such a serious attack that it's time that we breathe some life back into them.
And when did you put this on the ballot? And tell us a little more about who's behind it.
Well, we've been working on it for, I guess, 18 months to 2 years. And it was just a group of local parents that have concerns about things going on in their school districts, which are privacy invasive. And we were working, networking with Other People, which is the national parental rights organization, and they had Congressman Largent from Oklahoma carrying the Parental Rights and Responsibilities Act, and we went ahead and took that language and rewrote it for Colorado.
Well, Pat Stedman, what's your problem with this Parental Rights Amendment?
Protect Our Children Coalition feels that there's no need to change our state constitution to say that parents should have the rights to raise their kids. They already do that. Well, changing our constitution isn't going to make people into better parents. It's not going to make parents more responsible or more involved. We think changing the constitution will lead to some legal problems and some harmful side effects that could endanger Colorado children. And for that reason, over 140 groups, ranging from teachers in education, pediatricians, our state prosecutors, the district attorneys that prosecute child abuse cases, all sorts of groups are opposed to this amendment because the vague wording really goes too far and will have unintended and harmful side effects.
Wait a second, because this is quite a serious charge, and we'll have Leslie Hanks respond to it, but explain what you see as a connection between child abuse and the passage of the Parental Rights Amendment.
The District Attorney's Council in Colorado, which represents all 22 elected prosecutors in our state, has opposed this amendment because they feel it will complicate child abuse prosecutions by giving parents an inalienable right to discipline their children. They think this will make it more difficult to investigate cases, that more children who are in abusive situations will slip through the cracks and go undetected and not get the help they need, and that parents accused of child abuse could use this constitutional right as a defense. In fact, their defense attorneys have told us that they'd be negligent to their clients if they didn't use this constitutional right as a defense to try to escape prosecution for child abuse.
Leslie Hanks, are you concerned about this perhaps unintended outcome?
No, and I think it's very disingenuous for our opponents to make these allegations that they know that this language is not going to change the definition of child abuse. But what really amazes me is that most of the opponents don't even believe that children have a right to be born, and yet if they do get out of the mother's womb, then they want to be their greatest champions.
Well, our state prosecutors, the district attorneys in this state that have to deal with child abuse cases, they oppose this amendment because they think it'll make their job harder.
Well, I think that the situation is that they're actually part of the problem, and we feel that this local response to the grave national problem of bureaucracies and government not understanding what is the purview of parents and what is the proper limited role of government really needs to be addressed, because there are abuses against families going on every single day that are just outrageous.
And there are abuses against children that are equally outrageous, and I think this amendment would give irresponsible or abusive parents an excuse and a defense, and it'll make it harder to get children help, because this creates a right to sue any person that provides services or information to children if parents don't agree with whatever service or information was provided to their child. I think that's going to have a chilling effect on the willingness of professionals to help children, and it's going to leave children out in the cold, and I think that's really a tragedy about this amendment.
Leslie Hanks, can you give some examples on these egregious government intrusions into family life?
Yes, I can. The most egregious one that's come to light so far is a situation in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, last year, where there were 56 11- and 12-year-old girls marched down to the nurse's office and told that they had to disrobe, and the school district decided as part of Goals 2000 that these girls needed to have gynecological exams, even though they had never had that type of examination in the past, and their parents were unaware of that, and they were raped of their dignity, and that was completely outrageous. But the school district is totally unrepentant. They think they did nothing wrong, and they have no intention of changing their policy.
Well, I think you're playing a little loose and fast with the facts, Leslie, but why, because of what happened in Pennsylvania, should the Colorado Constitution be amended? We don't have those sort of problems in our state, and if we did, I think there are existing remedies that parents could already have a lawsuit against their school district for that sort of outrageous conduct. We don't need a constitutional amendment to make things like that wrong. It's just another reason why this amendment is so unnecessary and misguided, and again, we just really fear that it will lead to harmful side effects.
Well, I really believe that one of the reasons that we're doing it in Colorado is because if this is part of Goals 2000, the plan to go in and take over the medical decision-making capabilities for families on the part of the school district, we want to make sure that that's not going to be the case in Colorado.
We are talking to Leslie Hanks with the Coalition for Parental Responsibility, which supports this amendment known as Amendment 17, called the Parental Rights Amendment. And we're also joined by Pat Stedman, Deputy Campaign Director for Protect Our Children, a coalition of 140 groups, which is fighting the amendment. Now, listeners around the country will well remember a few years ago in Colorado, the amendment that was struck down by the courts, the Anti-Gay Initiative in Colorado. Is there any connection between the two of these? Pat Stedman.
Well, I think the genesis for these amendments is very similar. A lot of the same groups are supporting this amendment that supported that amendment 4 years ago. And I think actually some of the same motivations that were present 4 years ago are part of the stealth agenda that's hidden inside this parental rights amendment that we're seeing in 96.
Leslie Hanks, would you agree that there is a connection between the two?
Absolutely not. But interestingly enough, I know when we sat and formulated the language and everything, the task force folks, this never came up at all. But last weekend I went to the anti-parental rights rally that was held at the Capitol by Protect Our Children. And there were women from a group called the Lesbian Avengers with a great big banner, and they were wearing T-shirts that said on the back, "We recruit." And I guess it's troubling to me to think that that kind of an organization is bothered by the fact that parents have a right to raise their children. And so really this issue hasn't been even addressed until you guys brought it up today. I wouldn't say it's the same people at all, but since they brought it up, I guess it's appropriate to comment on it.
Pat Stedman.
Well, I think it's interesting that Leslie likes to point out the fact that one particular group that she dislikes is opposed to this amendment, when actually there's 140 organizations ranging from pediatricians and family physicians, school teachers, librarians, district attorneys, child advocates. All sorts of folks are opposed to this amendment for lots of different reasons, because it's so broad, it could have so many unintended consequences, so many impacts in different areas of law, from adoption to education to health care to child protection. And so that's why we've built such a broad coalition of opposition. And I think there's something in this amendment for everyone to dislike, and there's a reason, no matter who you are, for you to vote against it.
You know, I'm looking at a report that's just been put out by People for the American Way that's called Parental Rights, the Trojan Horse of the Religious Right Attack on Public Education. And it talks about the amendment as being a grassroots effort. It says that that Leslie Hanks, you and your group, Coalition for Parental Responsibility, talk about it as a grassroots effort to return control of public schools to the local level. However, the campaign is being financed by a national single-issue group headquartered in Virginia called Of the People. And Of the People, with religious rights support, currently is pushing parental rights legislation in 27 other states. Its chair, Jeffrey Bell, recently stated that there are 27 states waiting on Colorado. We will win there. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I know that it's a national parental rights, you know, organization, so it's logical that money would flow to that group in order to see that their efforts are successful. But I think it would be real appropriate for people to examine how much money Planned Parenthood is funding into this, because at least a third of the people that do oppose it are abortion advocates.
Pat Stedman, a response?
Well, I think, as I said, there's something in this amendment for all sorts of people to dislike. And it's true that Planned Parenthood has been very supportive of the Protect Our Children campaign, because they're concerned about the rights of teenagers right now in the state of Colorado to have confidential access to health care services and family planning. I think one of the legal results of Amendment 17 would be to end confidential access to health care services for teens. And that leaves teens, I think, in a dangerous situation, because studies have shown that in situations where teens have to tell a parent in order to get a condom or birth control, 25% won't do that and will go ahead and have sex without family planning or birth control. And so for that reason, I think Amendment 17 could have a negative impact on our teen pregnancy rates in Colorado, which there's an article in the newspaper this morning saying that they continue to be falling. But if, you know, there's no longer access to family planning, condoms, these sorts of things for teenagers, I'm afraid of what's going to happen.
Let's get some reading on the polls there and whether it looks like this amendment is going to pass.
Well, in early September, there was a poll that said 76% of Colorado voters favored this amendment. Just yesterday, a television station reported that that number is now 52%. What we've seen is that day by day, support for this amendment is steadily eroding. And that's because I think that there has been a vigorous debate about the amendment. It's generated a fair amount of controversy. People are hearing that this amendment isn't as simple and as attractive as it sounds on the surface, that actually it has very dangerous side effects. And the more people hear about it, the less they like it.
Interestingly enough, I heard last night on a different television program that we were still in the 60% range. So that's probably debatable. But I do believe that the advertising that the Planned Parenthood people will be doing all week will definitely take a toll.
Since you clearly both agree that this is the beginning of a movement around this country, again, this group Of the People, the religious right group based in Virginia, saying that there's currently parental rights legislation in 27 other states, why don't we get some phone numbers of each of your groups if people are interested in finding out about what's happening in their own state? Pat Stedman, the Protect Our Children group, the coalition of 140 groups fighting this Amendment 17?
Yes, we can be contacted in Denver at 303-360-8911.
That's 303-360-8911. And Leslie Hanks with the Coalition for Parental Responsibility.
They can be reached in Denver as well at 303-758-5715.
That's 303-758-5715. I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Leslie Hanks with the Coalition for Parental Responsibility, which has put forward this amendment called Amendment 17, or certainly behind supporting it, this group, as well as James Dobson's Focus on the Family and of the People in Virginia. And we also want to thank Pat Stedman, Deputy Campaign Director for Protect Our Children, which is fighting Amendment 17. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to take a look at the issue of globalization on this International Day of Action Against Global and Corporate Dominance. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In Boulder, Colorado today, Earth First is holding an action against Syntex Chemicals. Students at St. Cloud State University in Minnesota are protesting PepsiCo. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, Direct Action is demonstrating against Walmart. And in San Francisco, Earth First hopes to shut down the Pacific Stock Exchange. These events are part of an International Day of Action to end corporate dominance. With the exclusion of Ralph Nader and Ross Perot from national presidential debates, the subjects of corporate power and free trade have not emerged as issues in the 1996 elections. But some activists are still trying to inject these issues into the political debate. Jerry Mander and Edward Goldsmith are co-founders of the International Forum on Globalization, an organization of grassroots democracy, environmental, labor, and consumer activists who are beginning to name a common enemy: globalization. Mander and Goldsmith have just published a collection of essays on corporate power called The Case Against the Global Economy and For a Turn Toward the Local. It's published by Sierra Club Books. Larry Bensky and I spoke with the authors when they were recently in Washington. I asked Jerry Mander what has contributed to this unprecedented concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few.
Well, it's been going on for some time, but I think the most recently, the reason it's accelerated so much lately is a combination of the new technologies, which enable them to exercise control centrally and globally, using the new technologies of communication. They're enabled to keep their multi-armed presences together as never before, to speed up the scale of development, to instantaneously move capital and resources anywhere on the globe. Through the use of computer technology. So that's been a tremendous aid. The new trade regimes, of course, have essentially enabled them to wipe out the ability of nation states to control their laws or to exercise any control of these corporations. So they're now completely free of any national control or any community control. Any citizen sovereignty movements are much less effective because of this. And that combination has kind of revved up the speed and the scale of development as it never has been before. Some people say globalization has been going on for some time, and that's, of course, undeniably true. But now we're facing a tremendous acceleration, and with the new technology and the new trade instruments and the loss of power of national governments to stop them, there's really nothing in their way to kind of, as I said earlier, going for the gold. You know, they're going for all of it right now, for the last resources, for the last land, for... You know, it's just go for it right now. And I think citizens have lost tremendous amount of power, and so have nations lost tremendous amount of power.
Edward Goldsmith, when Jerry Mander talks about they have done this and it's being done by them, what do you understand to be they and them?
Well, this global economy was created largely by large corporations, desperate to obtain bigger and bigger markets and greater freedom to exploit these markets. And corporations have been trying to do that for a very long time. You may remember the free trade arrangements we had. We had free trade in the 1850s, going back a long, long way, when Britain dominated the world, very much as America dominated the world in 1944 at Bretton Woods. And we imposed a similar but weaker regime on the world, not for any other reason, but then to really maximize the interests of our corporations who dominated everything. They did it. I mean, it's their work. You see, that's of course they work through governments, but they control governments more and more. In my journal, The Ecologist, we documented in great detail how the Commission, the European Commission, is dominated by the European Round Table. The European Round Table represents the big businessmen of Europe. And we took two subjects. One was education and one was transport. And we looked at the reports written by the European Round Table on these subjects, and we found that everything they said was faithfully reflected, often word for word, in the reports established by the Commission, which served as policy documents. So it is perfectly clear that European policy is determined by these corporations. They've got to have a monopoly of money. And as Jerry tells you, they're in a position today, largely as a result of the signature of the GATT agreements and the setting up of the World Trade Organization, which they control, they're in a position in which they do what they like. We've had a global economy. We've reduced tariffs on trade since the war from an average of 40% to about 5%, but there's something completely new. Now we've discovered non-tariff barriers, which means that we now classify as barriers to trade all the fundamental laws that we've established over the last 40 or 50 years to protect local economies, to protect our society, to protect labor, and to protect the environment. All these laws, you see, can now be eliminated. They can be, all you have to do is to decree that they are non-tariff barriers to trade, and they can be declared GATT illegal. So we are.
But who are they and who are them who are doing this? Is it all corporations? Jerry Mander, you make the argument in this book that all corporations are per se, by their structure, immoral, impersonal, and bad.
My understanding and appreciation of it right now is that the corporations are who is driving this global economic experiment for their own self-interest, for short-run interests. And the people who are acting to control it are, of course, their representatives in organizations like the World Trade Organization and the GATT. Basically, the tribunals of these organizations are run by corporate people or corporate supporters who are, and these are non-transparent institutions. The public doesn't know what goes on in these tribunals when laws are considered for essentially reversal. And we've already had, in the United States alone, and just in the environmental area, we've had the Marine Mammal Protection Act directly threatened, the Clean Air Act, the Delaney Clause, the Raw Log Export Clause, the CAFE standards. These are all up for challenge in the GATT right now. And these are some of our most fundamental environmental laws.
We all know it's absolutely accepted that the erosion of the ozone layer is one of the more serious problems we face today. We know it's caused by a certain number of chlorinated chemicals we put in the atmosphere, in particular CFCs. And now we phase them out in the USA and phase them out in Europe. But what are the companies that produce them doing? They're getting them made in the third world instead. And I'm told that the second biggest article of contraband into America today, after cocaine, are CFCs. Now, how can you possibly defend this sort of action? How can these corporations cooperate with third world countries or establish themselves on the sly in third world countries to produce something which we know is going to make life very, very difficult on this planet, which will massively increase skin cancer and cause a host of other problems? How can that possibly be justified on moral grounds? It's almost impossible to find a more immoral attitude. And yet this is typical. It's the same with oil. Here we know we've got to do something about global warming, which is by far and away the most serious problem we face on this planet, which could make this planet uninhabitable in a matter of decades. And now there's almost total unanimity among climatologists on this issue, with except four or five whose names I know, and the names of the oil companies that pays them have been published. We know what they get for lying to the public, these experts. And yet here we find that the oil companies are doing everything they can to prevent any action being taken, you see, to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. Now, is it possible to imagine more immoral behavior? I don't know how you can do it. Is it worse than anything that the mafia does? I'll ask you that question. My opinion is probably not as bad. The mafia into prostitution. These people are into transforming this planet in order to make a little bit of money so as to make it literally uninhabitable to complex forms of life.
We're talking to Edward Goldsmith and Jerry Mander. They've both edited a book called The Case Against the Global Economy and For a Turn Toward the Local. At the top level with the corporations, capital knows no borders. The capital is global. It moves back and forth. And, of course, power is being more and more concentrated. That's up there. Down here are the people, and yet you see the borders increasing. You see the passage of the immigration bill in this country, which is sending people back and making it less possible for people to come into this country. You see the welfare repeal law passed, where at the top corporations are making more money, people at the bottom are getting poorer and poorer. How can that be countered?
Well, it can only be countered by, first of all, understanding the causes of these problems. I mean, the immigration problem is a really good example of the tremendous distortions of reporting or the failure to connect all the dots by the mass media on subjects like that, because the press has allowed the immigration thing to be fought out on this kind of xenophobic level led by people like Pat Buchanan and so on, when in fact the cause of this immigration is in many places, even in the United States, certainly in relationship to Mexico, but many places of Europe and elsewhere, it's because global institutions and global corporations have gone into places like Mexico, have destroyed the indigenous economy, very often quite on purpose, in the case of the World Bank, which even articulates the virtue of destroying the indigenous economy and the self-sufficient small-scale farming that might be going on in each of these locales, and driving, you know, putting it under corporate control, turning it into pesticide and mechanized agriculture, driving people off their lands away from their homes into cities where they can't find jobs, and then to some other country to seek that same kind of job.
Exactly.
But very often, it's us who has caused that
exactly.
situation, and they are then coming here to try to find a job, and then we, you know, have racist reactions to their coming here.
When you say it's us that caused that, explain what you mean. How did the U.S. government facilitate these corporations going to Mexico?
Well, corporations have been going to Mexico for some time, but the U.S. has also agitated for, you know, for example, under NAFTA and the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement as well. It's almost impossible for a nation to keep out foreign investment, so that now Mexico is completely subject to the power of the giant financial institutions in the United States, who can not only invest in Mexico, but no longer have to maintain just 49%. Now they can buy 100% of a so-called Mexican corporation and then set up a control of the Mexican economy very, very, very directly. And so when I say we, I don't mean me or you. I really mean the corporate structure and the U.S. government participation in that as a subordinate to that corporate structure, which has created the conditions that drive the people off their own land up here looking for jobs. And then we send them back again.
Exactly that. But especially this trend is going to be accentuated massively by the global economy. I mean, because the global economy is going to kill. The global economy is going to kill small farmers, and as artisans, small shopkeepers, small people are going to be wiped out, as they've been throughout the world where we've established, where we've set up structural adjustment programs, you see. They've gone. Now, you take a case like India. Well, there are probably 600 million people who live off the land or live off the farmers, small artisans. Most of those people, perhaps as many as 500 million, are going to be pushed off the land. It's inevitable. It cannot be avoided. In China, it'll be a billion. You see, what's going to happen to all these people, you see? They're going to flood into the slums. They're going to be pushed off the land to accommodate vast plantations, you see, mechanized plantations geared to the export trade. That's what it's all about. That's what's happened everywhere else. So you can predict in advance that you're going to get millions of marginalized people. I mean,
but presumably some of these people get jobs on these plantations.
Very, very small of them. There's no way in which we can provide jobs because, I mean, if you all get probably Jeremy Rifkin's book on the end of jobs, we've got a chapter by Jeremy Rifkin on the subject here. We believe that you could probably run the global economy on 20% of the world's population. You're going to marginalize an enormous proportion of the world's population. It's inevitable. If you think of all the small people going to be put out of business by this global economy. So there's no way these people will get jobs. You actually are going to marginalize something that's never happened before in history, an enormous proportion of the world's population.
John Cavan has a very good figure on this. He's of the Institute, he's, I'm sure, been on your show many times.
Institute,
he's also in the book. And he points out that the 200 largest corporations who are acting on the global stage very, very aggressively actually account for 200 corporations account for 25% of global economic activity, and at the same time provide 0.0001% of the jobs.
Yeah.
Because when the global economic activity is invariably more mechanistic. And more, it's not labor intensive kind of activity. They desperately seek to not hire people, and they have to hire a certain minimum to do certain tasks. But for the most part, they're not interested in that. Is a mechanization drive goes right along with globalization. So we can't look at that economy for expanded jobs.
But you go further than that, don't you, Jerry? You say that people really shouldn't be looking to jobs for their sustenance, not only their material sustenance, but also their role on Earth. They should be looking towards their community and towards their family and towards a renewed sense of producing things themselves. And when I think about this interview and it being broadcast, I visualize something I do in radio. Who's listening to this? And I think people jammed on traffic-choked freeways in Los Angeles at the end of drive time when this is being broadcast and are thinking to themselves, well, this is all very well and good about this, but I've got to get to my job, and this freeway is driving me nuts, and I've got to get my paycheck, or I can't feed my family, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. And you're basically trying to tell them, in some of the writings in this book, wait a minute, stop. It shouldn't be about that at all.
Well, first of all, there are 44 authors in this book, so everyone has a slightly different angle on it. I don't really try to tell people that they should give up their job and right now and go operate a farm. What we're operating, I think there's some fundamental assumption among all the authors here, which is that it is a corporate utopian fantasy to believe that globalizing economics is going to satisfy any of the ultimate needs of the vast majority of the citizens anywhere on the planet, and that the solutions lie in bringing real power back to where people can exercise it in some manner. And that is in the direction of smaller communities, local communities, regional controls, watershed communities in some cases. Bring power back to where democracy is operable, and minimizing or eliminating the power of centralized corporate global control.
I was recently in France. I go there a lot. And in Western Brittany, where I go, some friends of mine have started a non-cash culture labor and service exchange, because these are mostly poor people.
It's a let system, probably.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you write about that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be good to bring that to listeners' attention now to describe exactly what it is and how it might begin to help people on a local level disconnect from the corporate capitalist economy. Why don't one of you describe a let system?
It's in France. It's only been set up 2 years ago in France, probably even a year and a half, and it's spreading like lightning. There are about 50 schemes already, and especially in the poorer areas of the southwest, in the département de l'Aude and l'Ariège, it's becoming very important because people have no other sort of means of living. It simply means you create your own currency. And once you've got your own currency, you do your exchange things in the, on this currency. I will come and fix your electricity, and I get a credit in the local currency. And you fix somebody else's plumbing, and you get a credit. And we all get credits by doing fulfilling functions and sending things to people. And eventually, shops even come into the deal. You get small shops coming along. So you've got the basis, a basis of a new local economy using your own currency among people who otherwise would have no money. And many of whom will be seriously suffering from malnutrition, because let's not fool ourselves. This malnutrition is already beginning to occur. We've reached a situation in England in which a large proportion of the population can no longer feed his family. You know, as long-term contracts are reduced, you know, to short-term contracts, full-time jobs to part-time jobs, salaries are falling, the welfare state is being dismantled, people can no longer feed their families.
You know, and it's worth adding that there's a chapter in the book by Susan Meeker Lowry on the local currency systems in the United States. They're gaining tremendous popularity. There's also systems like community-supported agriculture, which basically operate outside the market system, where people can directly buy from organic farmers, and these things are growing tremendously. And one of the chapters in the – and there's a lot of – there's a 40 or 50 ideas proposed – or 30 or 40 ideas proposed for Helena Norberg – by Helena Norberg Hodge on new economic schemes, tax structures, and so on. But also there is a chapter in there on new – on what's called the new protectionism, which is basically – saying, you know, what is wrong? Protectionism's really gotten a bad name. What on earth is wrong with protectionism? You know, to act in the interests of your community by enforcing labor standards, by enforcing environmental standards, by developing a local economy so that for self-sufficiency rather than everything for export. This has a great promise, I think, and there are many, many – but nobody has the complete package put together. There's no doubt.
Well, maybe I'll make you feel good by – I'll try to make you feel good by telling you that when this interview's over, I'm going to bicycle home.
Oh, I know that.
On my way home.
I've seen you on the bicycles.
And on my way home, I'm going by the Berkeley Farmers Market, which sells today, and I'm going to buy almost all of what my household consumes this week right there.
On that note, we do have to wrap up. I want to thank Jerry Mander and Edward Goldsmith for joining us, authors of or editors of quite a tome, The Case Against the Global Economy and For a Turn Toward the Local. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. As we mentioned earlier, today is an International Day of Action to End Corporate Dominance. Demonstrations by environmental, consumer, and labor groups are taking place from Kaliningrad, Russia, to Oxford, England, Houston, Texas, to Toronto, Ontario, Port Elizabeth, South Africa, to Washington, D.C. One of the clearest examples of corporate dominance is the use of child and sweatshop labor by global corporations in the developing world. Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee has been fighting these sweatshops throughout Central America. He spoke a few weeks ago at a forum called Gender Justice, Forging Economic Rights in the Global Economy, sponsored by 50 Years is Enough and the Institute for Policy Studies.
You know how certain experiences in your life leave an impression on you. And last year, I was in Honduras, and we were talking to some of the young women who work in these industrial parks, these giant export processing zones. In Central America and the Caribbean today, there are 500,000, mostly young women, producing exclusively for export to the United States. In other words, there's 500,000 young women in Central America and the Caribbean working for U.S. companies, exporting to the U.S. Well, in one of these factories, we were talking to the women, and they were telling us, you know, we work from 8:30 in the morning until 7:30 in the morning, until 8:30 at night, 9:30 at night, Monday through Fridays. They said on Saturday we come in at 7:30 and we work right through the night. We come out 6 o'clock on Sunday morning. And I was looking at them and I was thinking to myself, they work 13 and 14 hour shifts Monday through Friday. They're 15 years old, 17 years old, 18 years old. They're telling me that they work 23 hours on Saturday night right through to Sunday morning. And I frankly found it hard to believe. I said, can I come back on Sunday morning and talk with you? And they said, oh, of course, please come back. Well, Honduras is a hot place. It's humid. It's hot. These kids were in the factory from 7:30 on Saturday morning, and they worked right through the night, 23 hours, and came out Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. And you see them straggling out of the factory with big bags under their eyes. And we met with a number of them. And, you know, we're asking them, how the hell did you stay awake? What did you do? And they say, well, you know, they play loud music. The management walks around, claps its hands. They scream at us. And they said up to a couple of months ago, they gave us little Dixie cups with the white pills in it. And they stopped that because a lot of the younger kids went into convulsions and vomited. Evidently, they were giving the kids some sort of amphetamines to work faster. They were working for Walmart producing Gentano shirts. We were standing there talking to the kids when the trailer trucks pulled out at 6:15 in the morning, Sunday morning, and went right to Puerto Cortez. That clothing would be in the United States 48 hours later, be there like Monday night. So we started talking to them, and it taught me a lot. We said to them, do you know where this clothing goes? And they said to us, no, not really. You know, we think it goes to the United States. Do you have any idea what companies you work for? No, we have no idea. We don't read the label. The label's in English. We don't know what companies we work for. I said to them, did you ever hear of Walmart, Gap, JCPenney? Did you ever hear of Kmart? Did you ever hear of Levi Strauss, Liz Claiborne? They said, nope, never heard of them. And then a few of them said, wait, Levi Strauss, we worked for a Korean contractor in Honduras who produced Dockers. And our contractor told us that Levi Strauss was a tiny mom and pop company and that it was going bankrupt and we would have to take a cut in wages and work harder and longer hours or else we were going to lose our jobs. They didn't know that Levi Strauss was the largest apparel company in the world and was enormously profitable. We asked them if they had any idea what the clothing sold for in the United States. They said, nope. We asked them if they knew what wages were in the United States. And they said no, and then they came back to us and they said, well, we don't know. We think wages are 40 cents an hour. They gave us the equivalent in Lempiras. 40 U.S. cents an hour is what the workers in the United States get paid. We asked them if they ever heard of corporate codes of conduct. You know, these are those, you know, first of all, they looked at us like we were from another planet. We explained, no, the U.S. companies have beautiful documents. They guarantee you your human rights. No forced labor, no child labor, right to organize, right to decent working conditions. And they looked at us like stunned. And then they laughed a little bit and they said, yeah, we have corporate code of conduct. It's a screwdriver and it's the sun. And then we looked at them and said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, they don't like what we're doing. They hit us on the head with the screwdriver or they put us out into the sun as a form of punishment. That was their corporate code of conduct. Asked them if they knew about the ILO. We asked them if they knew about the United Nations Bill of Rights. None of these things, absolutely not. And it was very clear that the U.S. companies would go offshore to a place like Honduras, to countries in Central America and the Caribbean, to countries in Asia, put their arms around very young women and bring them into the global economy with not a single tool to defend themselves. And in fact, the maquiladora owners there will tell you in Honduras that they like the 16-year-olds. They tell you, they're open about this. They say the 16-year-old girls, they reach their peak of eye-hand coordination at 16. And they sit there and they smile at you and they actually move their hands back and forth like that, showing you why the 16 years old are so good. Well, many people, some people might have heard of that wonderful advocate of child rights and women's rights, Kathy Lee Gifford. She's so good. She puts on her label here that a portion of the proceeds from the sale of this garment will go to various children's charities. The only difficulty was that children made this in Honduras. There were about 130 kids working in this plant, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. They were forced to work from 8 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. They were searched on the way in because the pants are white and they didn't want the kids getting candy on the pants. So God forbid they should have a Tootsie Roll. They had to be frisked on the way in. They weren't allowed to talk when they worked. The bathrooms were locked. There was an armed guard. They had to raise their hand. They could go to the bathroom twice. If they weren't working fast enough, they said the garments were sometimes thrown in their face. They were yelled at. If they tried to organize, they were fired. 38 workers were organized for trying to defend their rights. Like I said, the plant had four armed guards. They got paid 25 cents for every $19.96 pair of pants they made for Walmart. 25 cents. Well, that's only a, you know, if we back up from the concrete and come back to the U.S. government a little bit, I don't know if anybody's seen these ads or remember them, but here's gender justice here. These are ads that were taken out in U.S. magazines across the United States, in industry journals, and across Canada. And it tells you quality, industriousness, and reliability is what El Salvador offers you. Shows you a picture of a woman in a sewing machine. And it tells you Rosa Martinez produces apparel for U.S. markets on her sewing machine in El Salvador. You, it's underlined, can hire her for 57 cents an hour. These ads were paid for by the U.S. government with U.S. taxpayers' money under USAID. We gave the organization that took these ads $103 million. So the U.S. taxpayer paid for these ads, which were targeting U.S. companies to take the jobs offshore. We had the chance to go offshore posing as investors. Now I have to hop fast, but we formed a phony company. We wanted to see for ourselves what the USAID was doing, what the U.S. government was doing. So we went offshore posing as goofy environmentalists that, I shouldn't say that, but we had to play our role well. So we said we knew nothing about business, so we figured we'll pass ourselves off as environmentalists. We said we made shopping bags of canvas, 100% cotton, and we would get rid of paper and plastic bags. We went offshore, and we went into the companies, the U.S. companies, and we went to the U.S. government, El Salvador and Honduras, and they took us to a factory in Honduras called Best Form. And I won't forget it. We walked in. It was a company that made women's undergarments. And we walk in and we sit down and the owner's sitting there and we say to him, how is it in Honduras? Of course, all the products he was making were going to the United States. He says, it's beautiful here. I got 400 young girls working for me and they're docile. It's the best place I've ever been. And we said to him, we're thinking of coming down here. We like this stuff. We like this place. What we are worried about labor problems. We can't have labor problems when we first get down here. And he looks at it, he says, labor problems? Are you crazy? He said, you came through, you saw that building out there with the barbed wire around it? He said, there's a computerized blacklist in that building. They can't, troublemakers can't get into these zones. Religious people aren't getting in. Unionists aren't getting in. Troublemakers aren't getting in. People who are fired aren't getting in. He says, I don't know how it happened, but about, you know, 4 months ago, I hired this young girl, and I saw her handing out leaflets one day. And he leans back in his seat, and he says, we fired her. We kicked her ass out of here, and now she's on the list. His only problem is that he was saying this into a hidden camera that we had an attaché case. We went from him, we did this to all the U.S. companies and heard the same story over and over and over again. So we said, let's go to the U.S. government. So we went to the U.S. government in San Salvador, and obviously anybody who knows Central America, the U.S. embassies are always like a war zone. So you're not going to go into the U.S. embassy with hidden microphones and all the rest of it. So we played a trick, see how smart the embassy is. We told the embassy that we had eaten something the night before which didn't agree with us, made us a little sick. Would the embassy please come to our hotel for the meeting? And they fell for it immediately. They got in their van, they drove over to the hotel. We ran downstairs, tipped all the waiters. It was the Sheraton Hotel. We tipped the waiters, moved all the chairs around, set up the hidden camera in the attaché case, and in walks John Sullivan, the highest level U.S. government private sector official in El Salvador. And he walks in, and we had a long table set up with the attaché case with the camera there. We sat all around it and left him the seat right in line with the camera. We even practiced eating without bending in front of the camera. So we kept, he must have thought we're all nuts. We're all sitting there with straight backs. Anyway, he walks in and he says to us, we had the bag up, New Age Textiles. He says, well, we want your business here in El Salvador. He leans over and he goes like this. He says, 40 cents an hour. That's a world-class wage. He says, you're going to make a lot of money here. But don't keep the money hourly rate. He said, put them on a piece rate and speed them up. You're going to make a lot more money. Then he goes on. We ask him about the labor problems. He says, labor problems? He said, there's a computerized blacklist. Let me tell you how it operates. This is the head of the U.S. government. He says, they've got a list. You want 500 workers. He says, guaranteed 1,000 are going to show up. And his own management has the list. They will compare the list with the people coming through. And they can tell you, that one's a union organizer. That one was fired 2 months ago. That one's sister's a religious fanatic. He says, you get rid of them. Don't worry about it. They run a top-notch operation. This is the sort of reality that goes behind this global economy when you try to put a human face on it. And, you know, it, how sick these people get. Just give you one other quick example from USAID. The U.S. Agency for International Development grew very concerned in Honduras because the free trade zones that were producing for the U.S. market were booming. Booming. 31-cent wages, young girls, just what the U.S. companies wanted. But the companies were growing so fast, they were frightened of where they were going to get their young girls. So the U.S. government stepped in and paid Price Waterhouse to do a survey of the vegetative growth of young females in Honduras. So help me God, the vegetative growth of young females, and Price Waterhouse got right to it. And they studied, they charted the vegetative growth of young females against the growth of the need for the free trade zones, the U.S. companies. Terrible problem. The young girls were not growing as fast as the needs of the free trade zones. So Price Waterhouse turned around and did a survey of unemployment among 10 to 14-year-old girls. This is 1993. This is our U.S. government. This is our Price Waterhouse. This is our tax dollars. Well, those are examples of economic of gender injustice. But there's another side to this, gender justice. You know, there's too much of this kissing up to the companies, you know, and too much wanting to go behind back doors, you know, shake the hand with the boss and exchange letters, you know, nothing ever gets done. We find, as a few of us, our committee's quite small, but we believe we're way better off if we put ourselves in the shoes of those young girls who are working offshore, those young women, and try to be their voice and their eyes in the United States. Rather than sitting in some corporate office shaking hands with people, we'd much rather be on tour with this 50-year-old Wendy Diaz from Honduras, which we did last summer. It was remarkable. This worker who made the Kathy Lee pants, 15 years old, she left Honduras, and they told us in Honduras, they said, I don't know about this one. She doesn't talk. She doesn't say anything. You know, maybe she's going to fail in the United States. She left Honduras. She had a third-grade education. She lived in one room with 11 people. She earned 31 cents an hour making pants for Kathy Lee. She did the same motion 1,200 times a day, working 13-hour shifts. She came to the United States, and she took on Kathy Lee Gifford. She took on Walmart, the largest retail in the world, and she kicked their butt in. And Walmart right now, you know, no one had ever given this kid a chance to talk. And when the kid came to the United States, she was unstoppable. And gender justice for me was one day Business Week took us out in the street and they wanted to take some pictures. And we were standing together. She was quite small and they're taking our picture and everything. At one point, they wanted to take pictures of us separately. So I'm standing there and I turn around. This is in New York City on 38th Street, right in a sweatshop, garment district. I turn around and Wendy Diaz is up against the side of a building and she's got 40 people around her who recognized her from television. Women came to her. Undocumented workers and said, Wendy, you're our voice. Wendy, if you don't have documents in the United States, they put their foot on your neck. Wendy, fight for us. No one's fighting for us, Wendy. Fight for us and keep doing what you're doing. It was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen. This 50-year-old came to New York and moved the whole country. So there's the possibility for justice. I don't think we have the right to fail. I don't think that's if we're not being successful, we should stop what we're doing. And just one final note, another sign of gender justice. When we were running the Gap campaign, we got thousands of letters, but one letter really touched me. This was to push the gap towards independent monitoring. This is a letter from a preschool student involved in trying to make the companies responsible. It says, "Dear managers at the Gap, please don't buy from sweatshops. I hope you know what they do. They lock little girls up and make them work. These children are just like me. They should go to school instead of sweatshops. I like your clothes, but I'll stop buying from you until you stop buying from sweatshops." From Suzanne Pope. P.S. I told my class on you. This kind of stuff is what brought the Gap to its knees. The Gap took a look at this stuff and they were quickly at the table. Just so we know what we're up against. You know, I was just looking through some articles, and there's a nice company in New Jersey called Avalon, and they make little trinkets like lapels. and they're making a fortune. So they became the focus of an economic series in the newspaper here. And I want to read you a quote from this manager here, the owner. He says, "We have a factory in China where we have 250 people. We own them. It's our factory. We pay them $40 a month, and they work 28 days a month. They work from 7 a.m. until 11 p.m. with two breaks for lunch and dinner. They all eat together, 16 people to a room, stacked up on four bunks in a corner. Generally, they're young girls that come in from the countryside." This bum made 150,000 lapels for the Republican National Convention in China, in this factory, using young girls, working them 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, with every second Sunday off. This is what we're up against.
Charlie Kernighan, director of the National Labor Committee, based in New York City. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, a debate on Social Security. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Standard Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 15 seconds. Universal Time, 14 hours, 59...